Chapter 3 Playing Castles 1 There followed a week of the sort of weather that makes folks apt to crawl back into bed after lunch, take long naps, and wake feeling stupid and disoriented. It was far from flood weather, but it made the final phase of the apple picking dangerous. There were several broken legs, and in Seven Mile Orchard a young woman fell from the top of her ladder, breaking her back. And the potato fields became difficult to work. Almost as much time was spent freeing wagons stuck in the gluey rows as was spent actually picking. In Greenheart, what decorations had been done for the reaping fair grew sodden and had to be pulled down. The work volunteers waited with increasing nervousness for the weather to break so they could begin again. It was bad weather for young men whose job it was to take inventory, although they were at least able to begin visiting barns and counting stock. It was good weather for a young man and young woman who had discovered the joys of physical love, you would have said. But Roland and Susan met only twice during the run of gray weather. The danger of what they were doing was now almost palpable. The first time was in an abandoned boathouse on the Seacoast Road. The second was in the far end of the crumbling building below and to the east of Sitgo. They made love with furious intensity on one of Roland's saddle blankets, which was spread on the floor of what had once been the oil refinery's cafeteria. As Susan climaxed, she shrieked his name over and over. Startled pigeons filled the old shadowy rooms and crumbling hallways with their soft thunder. 2. Just as it seemed that the drizzle would never end and the grinding sound of the thinny in the still air would drive everyone in Hanbury insane, a strong wind, almost a gale, blew in off the ocean and puffed the clouds away. The town awoke one day to a sky as bright as blue steel and a sun that turned the bay to gold in the morning and white fire in the afternoon. That sense of lethargy was gone. In the potato fields, the carts rolled with new vigor. In Greenheart, an army of women began once more to bedeck with flowers the podium where Jamie McCann and Susan Delgado would be acclaimed this year's reaping lad and girl. Out on the part of the drop closest to Mayor's house, Roland, Cuthbert, and Alan rode with renewed purpose, counting the horses which ran with the barony brand on their flanks. The bright skies and brisk winds filled them with energy and good cheer, and for a course of days, three or perhaps four, they galloped together in a whooping, shouting, laughing line, their old good fellowship restored. On one of these brisk and sunny days, Eldred Jonas stepped out of the sheriff's office and walked up Hill Street toward Greenheart. He was free of both DePape and Reynolds this morning. They had ridden out to Hanging Rock together, looking for Letigo's outriders, who must come soon now. And Jonas's plan was simple: to have a glass of beer in the pavilion and watch the preparations that were going on there. The digging of the roasting pits, the laying of faggots for the bonfire, the arguments over how to set the mortars that would shoot off the fireworks, the ladies flowering the stage where this year's lad and girl would be offered for the town's adulation. Perhaps, Jonas thought, he might take a likely-looking flower girl off for an hour or two of recreation. The maintenance of the saloon whores he left strictly to Roy and Clay, but a fresh young flower girl of 17 or so was a different matter. The pain in his hip had faded with the damp weather. The painful, lurching stride with which he had moved for the last week or so had become a mere limp again. Perhaps just a beer or two in the open air would be enough. But the thought of a girl wouldn't quite leave his head. Young, clear-skinned, high-breasted, fresh, sweet breath, fresh, sweet lips. Mr. Jonas? Eldred? He turned, smiling, to the owner of the voice. No dewy-complexioned flower girl with wide eyes and moist, parted lips stood there, but a skinny woman edging into late middle age, flat chest, flat bum, tight, pale lips, hair scrooped so tight against her skull that it fair screamed. Only the wide eyes corresponded with his daydream. I believe I've made a conquest, Jonas thought sardonically. Why, Cordelia, he said, reaching out and taking one of her hands in both of his. How lovely you look this morning. Thin color came up in her cheeks and she laughed a little. For a moment she looked 45 instead of 60. And she's not 60, Jonas thought. The lines around her mouth and the shadows under her eyes, those are new. You're very kind, she said, but I know better. I haven't been sleeping, and when women my age don't sleep, they grow old rapidly. I'm sorry to hear you're sleeping badly, he said. But now that the weather's changed, perhaps...
It's not the weather. Might I speak to you, Eldred? I've thought and thought, and you're the only one I dare turn to for advice.
His smile widened. He placed her hand through his arm, then covered it with his own. Now her blush was like fire. With all that blood in her head, she might talk for hours. And Jonas had an idea that every word would be interesting. Three. With women of a certain age and temperament, tea was more effective than wine when it came to loosening the tongue. Jonas gave up his plans for a lager and perhaps a flower girl without so much as a second thought. He seated Cy Delgado in a sunny corner of the Greenheart Pavilion, it was not far from a red rock Roland and Susan knew well, and ordered a large pot of tea, cakes too. They watched the reaping fair preparations go forward as they waited for the food and drink. The sun-swept park was full of hammering and sawing and shouts and bursts of laughter. All fair days are pleasant, but reaping turns us all into children again, don't you find? Cordelia asked. Yes, indeed, said Jonas, who hadn't felt like a child even when he had been one. What I still like best is the bonfire, she said, looking toward the great pile of sticks and boards that was being constructed at the far end of the park, catter-corner from the stage. It looked like a large wooden teepee. I love it when the townsfolk bring their stuffy guys and throw them on. Barbaric, but it always gives me such a pleasant shiver.
Aye, Jonas said, and wondered if it would give her a pleasant shiver to know that three of the stuffy guys thrown onto the Reap Night bonfire this year were apt to smell like pork and scream like harpies as they burned. If his luck was in, the one that screamed the longest would be the one with the pale blue eyes.
The tea and cakes came, and Jonas didn't so much as glance at the girl's full bosom when she bent to serve. He had eyes only for the fascinating Cy Delgado, with her nervous little shifting movements and odd, desperate look. When the girl was gone, he poured out, put the teapot back on its trivet, then covered her hand with his.
"Now, Cordelia," he said in his warmest tone. I can see something troubles you. Out with it. Confide in your friend Eldred.
Her lips pressed so tightly together that they almost disappeared, but not even that effort could stop their trembling. Her eyes filled with tears, swam with them, overspilled. He took his napkin and, leaning across the table, wiped the tears away.
Tell me, he said tenderly.
I will. I must tell somebody or go mad. But you must make one promise, Eldred.
Of course, Molly.
He saw her blush more furiously than ever at this harmless endearment and squeezed her hand.
Anything.
You mustn't tell Hart, that disgusting spider of a chancellor either, but especially not the mayor. If I'm right in what I suspect and he found out, he could send her west.
She almost moaned this, as if comprehending it as a real fact for the first time.
He could send us both west.
Maintaining his sympathetic smile, he said,
Not a word to Mayor Thorin, not a word to Kimber Rymer. Promise.
For a moment he thought that she wouldn't take the plunge, or perhaps couldn't. Then, in a low, gaspy voice that sounded like ripping cloth, she said a single word.
Dearborn!
He felt his heart take a bump as the name that had been so much in his mind now passed her lips, and although he continued to smile, he could not forbear a single hard squeeze of her fingers that made her wince.
"I'm sorry," he said. "It's just that you startled me a little. Dearborn, a well-spoken enough lad, but I wonder if he's entirely trustworthy."
"I fear he's been with my Susan."
Now it was her turn to squeeze, but Jonas didn't mind. He hardly felt it, in fact. He continued to smile, hoping he did not look as flabbergasted as he felt.
"I fear he's been with her, as a man is with a woman. Oh, how horrible this is!"
She wept with a silent bitterness, taking little pecking peeks around as she did to make sure they were not being observed. Jonas had seen coyotes and wild dogs look around from their stinking dinners in just that fashion. He let her get as much of it out of her system as he could. He wanted her calm, incoherencies wouldn't help him. And when he saw her tears slackening, he held out a cup of tea. "Drink this."
"Yes, thank you."
The tea was still hot enough to steam, but she drank it down greedily.
Her old throat must be lined with slate, Jonas thought.
She set the cup down, and while he poured out fresh, she used her frilly panuelo to scrub the tears almost viciously from her face.
"I don't like him," she said. "Don't like him, don't trust him. None of those three with their fancy in-world bows and insolent eyes and strange ways of talking, but him in particular. Yet if anything's gone on betwixt the two of them, and I'm so afraid it has, it comes back to her, doesn't it? It's the woman, after all, who must refuse the bestial impulses."
He leaned over the table, looking at her with warm sympathy.
"Tell me everything, Cordelia."
She did. Four. Rhea loved everything about the glass ball, but what she especially loved was the way it unfailingly showed her people at their vilest. Never in its pink reaches did she see one child comforting another after a fall at play, or a tired husband with his head in his wife's lap, or old people supping peacefully together at the end of the day. These things held no more interest for the glass, it seemed, than they did for her. Instead, she had seen acts of incest, mothers beating children, husbands beating wives. She had seen a gang of boys out westwards of town. It would have amused Rhea to know these swaggering 8-year-olds called themselves the Big Coffin Hunters, go about enticing stray dogs with a bone and then cutting off their tails for a lark. She had seen robberies and at least one murder, a wandering man who had stabbed his companion with a pitchfork after some sort of trivial argument. That had been on the first drizzly night. The body still lay moldering in a ditch beside the great road west, covered with a layer of straw and weeds. It might be discovered before the autumn storms came to drown another year, it might not. She also glimpsed Cordelia Delgado and that hard gun Jonas sitting in Green Heart at one of the outside tables and talking about, well, of course she didn't know, did she? But she could see the look in the spinster bitch's eyes. Infatuated with him she was, all pink in the face, gone all hot and sweet over a backshooter and failed gunslinger. It was comical, aye. And Rhea thought she would keep an eye on them from time to time. Very entertaining, it would likely be. After showing her Cordelia and Jonas, the glass veiled itself once more. Rhea put it back in the box with the eye on the lock. Seeing Cordelia in the glass had reminded the old woman that she had unfinished business regarding Cordelia's sluttish niece. That Rhea still hadn't done that business was ironic, but understandable. As soon as she had seen how to fix the young size wagon, Rhea's mind and emotions had settled again. The images in the ball had reappeared, and in her fascination with them, Rhea had temporarily forgotten that Susan Delgado was alive. Now, however, she remembered her plan. Set the cat among the pigeons. And speaking of cats,
"Musty, you who, Musty, where are ye?"
The cat came oiling out of the woodpile, eyes glowing in the dirty dimness of the hut. When the weather turned fine again, Rhea had pulled her shutters to, forked tail waving. He jumped into her lap.
"I've an errand for you," she said, bending over to lick the cat. The entrancing taste of Musty's fur filled her mouth and throat. Musty purred and arched his back against her lips. For a six-legged mutey cat, life was good.
5. Jonas got rid of Cordelia as soon as he could, although not as soon as he would have liked, because he had to keep the scrawny bent sweetened up. She might come in handy another time. In the end, he had kissed her on the corner of her mouth, which caused her to turn so violently red he feared she might have a brainstorm, and told her that he would check into the matter which so concerned her.
"But discreetly," she said, alarmed.
Yes, he said, walking her home, he would be discreet. Discretion was his middle name. He knew Cordelia couldn't be eased until she knew for sure, but he guessed it would turn out to be nothing but vapor. Teenagers loved to dramatize, didn't they? And if the young lass saw that her aunt was afraid of something, she might well feed auntie's fears instead of allaying them. Cordelia had stopped by the white picket fence that divided her garden plot from the road, an expression of sublime relief coming over her face. Jonas thought she looked like a mule having its back scratched with a stiff brush.
"Why, I never thought of that. Yet it's likely, isn't it?"
"Likely enough," Jonas had said, "but I'll still check into it most carefully. Better safe than sorry." He kissed the corner of her mouth again. And not a word to the fellows at Seafront. Not a hint.
"Thank ye, Eldred. Oh, thank ye."
And she had hugged him before hurrying in, her tiny breasts pressing like stones against the front of his shirt.
"Mayhap I'll sleep tonight after all."
She might, but Jonas wondered if he would. He walked toward Hookie's stable, where he kept his horse, with his head down and his hands locked behind his back. A gaggle of boys came racing up the other side of the street. Two of them were waving severed dogs' tails with blood clotted at the ends.
"Coffin hunters! We're big coffin hunters, just like you!"
one called impudently across to him. Jonas drew his gun and pointed it at them. It was done in a flash, and for a moment the terrified boys saw him as he really was. With his eyes blazing and his lips peeled back from his teeth, Jonas looked like a white-haired wolf in man's clothes.
"Get on, you little bastards," he snarled. "Get on before I blow you loose of your shoes and give your fathers cause to celebrate."
For a moment they were frozen, and then they fled in a howling pack. One had left his trophy behind. The dog's tail lay on the board sidewalk like a grisly fan. Jonas grimaced at the sight of it, holstered his gun, locked his hands behind him again, and walked on, looking like a parson meditating on the nature of the gods. And what in God's name was he doing pulling iron on a bunch of young hellions like that? Being upset, he thought, being worried. He was worried, all right. The titless old biddy's suspicions had upset him greatly. Not on Thorin's account. As far as Jonas was concerned, Dearborn could fuck the girl in the town square at high noon of Reaping Fair Day. But because it suggested that Dearborn might have fooled him about other things. "Crept up behind you once, he did, and you swore it'd never happen again. But if he's been diddling that girl, it has happened again, hasn't it?" Aye, as they said in these parts. If the boy had had the impertinence to begin an affair with the mayor's Jillian-waiting and the incredible slyness to get away with it, what did that do to Jonas's picture of three in-world brats who could barely find their own behinds with both hands and a candle? "We underestimated him once, and they made us look like monkeys," Clay had said. "I don't want it to happen again." Had it happened again? How much, really, did Dearborn and his friends know? How much had they found out? And who had they told? If Dearborn had been able to get away with pronging the mayor's chosen to put something that large over on Eldred Jonas, on everyone, "Good day, Si Jonas," Brian Hookey said. He was grinning widely, all but kowtowing before Jonas with his sombrero crushed against his broad blacksmith's chest.
"Would you care for fresh graft, Si?
I've just gotten the new pressing, and all I want is my horse," Jonas said curtly. "Bring it quick and stop your quacking."
"Aye, so I will. Happy to oblige. Thank you, Si."
He hurried off on the errand, taking one nervous, grinning look back over his shoulder to make sure he wasn't going to be shot out of hand. 10 minutes later, Jonas was headed west on the Great Road. He felt a ridiculous but nevertheless strong desire to simply kick his horse into a gallop and leave all this foolishness behind him. Thorin, the graying goat boy, Roland and Susan with their no doubt mawkish teenage love, Roy and Clay with their fast hands and slow wits, Rhymer with his ambitions, Cordelia Delgado with her ghastly visions of the two of them in some bosky dell, him likely reciting poetry while she wove a garland of flowers for his brow. He had ridden away from things before when intuition whispered plenty of things. But there would be no riding away this time. He had vowed vengeance on the brats, and while he had broken a bushel of promises made to others, he'd never broken one made to himself. And there was John Farson to consider. Jonas had never spoken to the good man himself, and never wanted to. Farson was reputed to be whimsically, dangerously insane. But he had had dealings with George Letigo, who would probably be leading the troop of Farson's men that would arrive any day now. It was Letigo who had hired the big coffin hunters in the first place, paying a huge cash advance, which Jonas hadn't yet shared with Reynolds and DePape, and promising an even larger piece of war spoil if the affiliation's major forces were wiped out in or around the Shaved Mountains. Letigo was a good-sized bug, all right, but nothing to the size of the bug trundling along behind him. And besides, no large reward was ever achieved without risk. If they delivered the horses, oxen, wagons of fresh vegetables, the tack, the oil, the glass, most of all the wizard's glass, all would be well. If they failed, it was very likely that their heads would end up being whacked about by Farson and his aides in their nightly polo games. It could happen, and Jonas knew it. No doubt someday it would happen. But when his head finally parted company from his shoulders, the divorce wouldn't be caused by any such smarms as Dearborn and his friends, no matter whose bloodline they had descended from. But if he's been having an affair with Thorin's autumn treat, if he's been able to keep such a secret as that, what others has he been keeping? Perhaps he is playing castles with you. If so, he wouldn't play for long. The first time young Mr. Dearborn poked his nose around his hillock, Jonas would be there to shoot it off for him. The question for the present was where to go first. Out to the bar K to take a long overdue look at the boys' living quarters? He could. They would be counting barony horses on the drop, all three of them. But it wasn't over horses that he might lose his head, was it? No. The horses were just a small added attraction as far as the good man was concerned. Jonas rode for Sitgo instead.
6. First he checked the tankers. They were just as had been and should be, lined up in a neat row with their new wheels ready to roll when the time came, and hidden behind their new camouflage. Some of the screening pine branches were turning yellow at the tips, but the recent spell of rain had kept most admirably fresh. There had been no tampering that Jonas could see. Next, he climbed the hill, walking beside the pipeline and pausing more and more frequently to rest. By the time he reached the rotting gate between the slope and the oil patch, his bad leg was paining him severely. He studied the gate, frowning over the smudges he saw on the top rung. They might mean nothing, but Jonas thought someone might have climbed over the gate rather than risk opening it and having it fall off its hinges. He spent the next hour strolling around the derricks, paying especially close attention to those that still worked, looking for sign. He found plenty of tracks, but it was impossible, especially after a week of wet weather, to read them with any degree of accuracy. The in-world boys might have been out here. That ugly little band of brats from town might have been out here.
Arthur Eld and the whole company of his knights might have been out here. The ambiguity put Jonas in a foul temper, as ambiguity other than on a castle's board always did. He started back the way he'd come, meaning to descend the slope to his horse and ride back to town. His leg was aching like fury, and he wanted a stiff drink to quiet it down. The bunkhouse at the Bar K could wait another day. He got halfway to the gate, saw the weedy spur track tying Sitgo to the great road, and sighed. There would be nothing on that little strip of road to see, but now that he'd come all the way out here, he supposed he should finish the job.
Bugger finishing the job. I want a damn drink.
But Roland wasn't the only one who sometimes found his wishes overruled by training. Jonas sighed, rubbed at his leg, then walked back to the weedy twin ruts. Where, it seemed, there was something to find after all. It lay in the grassy ditch less than a dozen paces from the place where the old road joined the great road. At first he saw only a smooth white shape in the weeds and thought it was a stone. Then he saw a black roundness that could only be an eye hole. Not a stone, then. A skull. Grunting, Jonas knelt and fished it out while the few living derricks continued to squeal and thump behind him. A rook's skull. He had seen it before. Hell, he suspected most of the town had. It belonged to the show-off, Arthur Heath, who, like all show-offs, needed his little props.
He called it the lookout, Jonas murmured. Put it on the horn of his saddle sometimes, didn't he? And sometimes wore it around his neck like a pendant.
Yes, the youngster had been wearing it so that night in the Traveler's Rest, when Jonas turned the bird's skull. Something rattled inside, like a last lonely thought. Jonas tilted it, shook it over his open palm, and a fragment of gold chain dropped out. That was how the boy had been wearing it. At some point the chain had broken, the skull had fallen in the ditch, and Cy Heath had never troubled to go looking for it. The thought that someone might find it had probably never crossed his mind. Boys were careless. It was a wonder any ever grew up to be men. Jonas's face remained calm as he knelt there examining the bird's skull. But behind the unlined brow, he was as furious as he had ever been in his life. They had been out here all right. It was another thing he would have scoffed at just yesterday. He had to assume they had seen the tankers, camouflage or no camouflage. And if not for the chance of finding this skull, he never would have known for sure, one way or the other.
When I finish with them, their eye sockets will be as empty as yours, Sir Rook. I'll gouge him clean myself.
He started to throw the skull away, then changed his mind. It might come in handy. Carrying it in one hand, he started back to where he'd left his horse. 7. Coral Thorin walked down High Street toward the Traveler's Rest, her head thumping rustily and her heart sour in her breast. She had been up only an hour, but her hangover was so miserable it felt like a day already. She was drinking too much of late, and she knew it, almost every night now, but she was very careful not to take more than one or two, and always light ones, where folks could see. So far, she thought no one suspected. And as long as no one suspected, she supposed she would keep on. How else to bear her idiotic brother, this idiotic town? And, of course, the knowledge that all of the ranchers in the Horsemen's Association and at least half of the large landowners were traitors.
"Fuck the affiliation," she whispered. "Better a bird in the hand."
But did she really have a bird in the hand? Did any of them? Would Farson keep his promises? Promises made by a man named Letigo and passed on by their own inimitable Kimba Reimer? Coral had her doubts. Despots had such a convenient way of forgetting their promises, and birds in the hand such an irritating way of pecking your fingers, shitting in your palm, and then flying away. Not that it mattered now, she had made her bed.
Besides, folks would always want to drink and gamble and rut, regardless of who they bowed their knees to or in whose name their taxes were collected. Still, when the voice of old demon conscience whispered, a few drinks helped to still its lips. She paused outside Craven's undertaking parlor, looking upstreet at the laughing boys on their ladders, hanging paper lanterns from high poles and building eaves. These gay lamps would be lit on the night of Reap Fair, filling Hambry's Main Street with 100 shades of soft, conflicting light. For a moment, Coral remembered the child she had been, looking at the colored paper lanterns with wonder, listening to the shouts and rattle of the fireworks, listening to the dance music coming from Greenheart as her father held her hand and, on his other side, her big brother Hart's hand. In this memory, Hart was proudly wearing his first pair of long trousers. Nostalgia swept her, sweet at first, then bitter. The child had grown into a sallow woman who owned a saloon and whorehouse, not to mention a great deal of land along the drop, a woman whose only sexual partner of late was her brother's chancellor, a woman whose chief goal upon arising these days was getting to the hair of the dog that bit her as soon as possible. How exactly had things turned out so? This woman whose eyes she used was the last woman the child she had been would have expected to become. "Where did I go wrong?" she asked herself, and laughed. "Oh, dear man, Jesus, where did this straying sinner child go wrong? Can you say hallelujah?" She sounded so much like the wandering preacher woman that had come through town the year before, Pittston, her name had been, Sylvia Pittston, that she laughed again, this time almost naturally. She walked on toward the rest with a better will. Shimi was outside, tending to the remains of his silk flowers. He waved to her and called a greeting. She waved back and called something in return. A good enough lad, Shimi. And although she could have found another easily enough, she supposed she was glad DePape hadn't killed him. The bar was almost empty, but brilliantly lit, all the gas jets flaring. It was clean as well. Shimi would have emptied the spittoons, but Coral guessed it was the plump woman behind the bar who had done all the rest. The makeup couldn't hide the sallowness of that woman's cheeks, the hollowness of her eyes, or the way her neck had started to go all crepey. Seeing that sort of lizardy skin on a woman's neck always made Coral shiver inside. It was Patty the Trotter tending bar beneath the romp's stern glass gaze, and if allowed to do so, she would continue until Stanley appeared and banished her. Patty had said nothing out loud to Coral, she knew better, but had made her wants clear enough just the same. Her whoring days were almost at an end. She desperately desired to go to work tending bar. There was precedent for it, Coral knew, a female bartender at Forest Trees in Pass of the River, and there had been another at Glen Cove up the coast in Tavares until she had died of the pox. What Petty refused to see was that Stanley Ruiz was younger by 15 years and in far better health. He would be pouring drinks under the romp long after Petty was rotting, instead of trotting, in a pauper's grave.
"Good even, Si Thorin,"
Petty said, and before Coral could so much as open her mouth, the whore had put a shot glass on the bar and filled it full of whiskey. Coral looked at it with dismay. Did they all know then?
"I don't want that," she snapped. "Why in hell's name would I? Sun isn't even down. Pour it back into the bottle for your father's sake, and then get the hell out of here. Who do you think you're serving at 5 o'clock anyway, ghosts?"
Petty's face fell a foot. The heavy coat of her makeup actually seemed to crack apart. She took the funnel from under the bar, stuck it in the neck of the bottle, and poured the shot of whiskey back in. Some went onto the bar, in spite of the funnel, her plump hands, now ringless, her rings had been traded for food at the mercantile across the street long since, were shaking.
"I'm sorry, Si. So I am. I was only—" "I don't care what you was only," Coral said,
and turned a bloodshot eye on Sheb, who had been sitting on his piano bench and leafing through old sheet music. Now he was staring toward the bar with his mouth hung open.
"And what are you looking at, you frog?"
"Nothing, Si Thorin. Then go look at it somewhere else. Take this pig with you. Give her a good bounce, why don't you? It'll be good for her skin. Might even be good for your own." "Get out! Are you deaf? Both of you!"
Patty and Sheb went away toward the kitchen instead of the cribs upstairs, but it was all the same to Coral. They could go to hell as far as she was concerned, anywhere, as long as they were out of her aching face. She went behind the bar and looked around. Two men playing cards over in the far corner. That hard case Reynolds was watching them and sipping a beer. There was another man at the far end of the bar, but he was staring off into space, lost in his own world. No one was paying any especial attention to Cy Coral Thorin, and what did it matter if they were? If Patty knew, they all knew. She ran her finger through the puddle of whiskey on the bar, sucked it, ran it through again, sucked it again. She grasped the bottle, but before she could pour, a spidery monstrosity with gray-green eyes leaped hissing onto the bar. Coral shrieked and stepped back, dropping the whiskey bottle between her feet, where, for a wonder, it didn't break. For a moment she thought her head would break instead, that her swelling, throbbing brain would simply split her skull like a rotten eggshell. There was a crash as the card players overturned their table, getting up. Reynolds had drawn his gun. "Nay," she said, in a quavering voice she could hardly recognize. Her eyeballs were pulsing and her heart was racing. People could die of fright, she realized that now. "Nay, gentlemen, all's well." The six-legged freak standing on the bar opened its mouth, bared its needle fangs, and hissed again. Coral bent down, and as her head passed below the level of her waist, she was once more sure it was going to explode, picked up the bottle, saw that it was still a quarter full, and drank directly from the neck, no longer caring who saw her do it or what they thought. As if hearing her thought, Musty hissed again. He was wearing a red collar this afternoon. On him it looked baleful rather than jaunty. Beneath it was tucked a white scrap of paper.
"Want me to shoot it?" a voice drawled. "I will, if you like. One slug and won't be nothing left but claws."
It was Jonas, standing just inside the bat wings, and although he looked not a whole lot better than she felt, Coral had no doubt he could do it.
"Nay, the old bitch'll turn us all into locusts or something like, if you kill her familiar."
"What bitch?" Jonas asked, crossing the room.
"Rhea Dubitivo. Rhea of the Coos, she's called."
"Ah, not the bitch, but the witch."
"She's both."
Jonas stroked the cat's back. It allowed itself to be petted, even arching against his hand, but he only gave it the single caress. Its fur had an unpleasant, damp feel.
"Would you consider sharing that?" he asked, nodding toward the bottle. "It's early, but my leg hurts like a devil sick of sin."
"Your leg, my head, early or late, on the house."
Jonas raised his white eyebrows.
"Count your blessings and have at it, Cully."
She reached toward Musty. He hissed again, but allowed her to draw the note out from under his collar. She opened it and read the five words that were printed there.
"I'm dry. Send the boy."
"Might I see?"
Jonas asked. With the first drink down and warming his belly, the world looked better.
"Why not?"
She handed him the note. Jonas looked, then handed it back. He had almost forgotten Rhea, and that wouldn't have done at all.
Ah, but it was hard to remember everything, wasn't it?
Just lately, Jonas felt less like a hired gun than a cook trying to make all nine courses of a state dinner come out at the same time. Luckily, the old hag had reminded him of her presence herself. God's bless her thirst. And his own, since it had landed him here at the right time.
"Shimi!"
Coral bawled. She could also feel the whiskey working. She felt almost human again. She even wondered if Eldred Jonas might be interested in a dirty evening with the mayor's sister. Who knew what might speed the hours? Shimi came in through the bat wings, hands grimy, pink sombrero bouncing on his back at the end of its cuerda.
"Aye, Coral Thorin, here I be."
She looked past him, calculating the sky. Not tonight. Not even for Rhea. She wouldn't send Shimi up there after dark, and that was the end of it.
"Nothing," she said, in a voice that was gentler than usual. "Go back to your flowers, and see that you cover them well. It bids frosty."
She turned over Rhea's note and scrawled a single word on it. Tomorrow. This she folded and handed to Jonas.
Stick it under that stink's collar for me, will you? I don't want to touch him.
Jonas did as he was asked. The cat favored them with a final wild, green look, then leaped from the bar and vanished beneath the bat wings.
Time is short, Coral said.
She hadn't the slightest idea what she meant, but Jonas nodded in what appeared to be perfect understanding.
Would you care to go upstairs with a closet drunk? I'm not much in the looks department, but I can still spread 'em all the way to the edge of the bed, and I don't just lie there.
He considered, then nodded. His eyes were gleaming. This one was as thin as Cordelia Delgado, but what a difference, eh? What a difference.
All right. I've been known to say some nasty things. Fair warning.
Dear lady, I shall be all ears. She smiled. Her headache was gone.
I just bet you will.
Give me a minute. Don't move a step. He walked across to where Reynolds sat.
Drag up a chair, Eldred.
I think not. There's a lady waiting. Reynolds's gaze flicked briefly toward the bar.
You're joking.
I never joke about women, Clay. Now mark me. Reynolds sat forward, eyes intent. Jonas was grateful this wasn't DePape. Roy would do what you asked, and usually well enough, but only after you'd explained it to him half a dozen times.
Go to Lengo, he said. Tell him we want to put about a dozen men, no less than 10, out at yon oil patch. Good men who can get their heads down and keep them down, and not snap the trap too soon on an ambush, if ambushing's required. Tell him Brian Hookey's to be in charge. He's got a level head, which is more than can be said for most of these poor things.
Reynolds's eyes were hot and happy. You expect the brats?
They've been out there once. Mayhap they'll be out again. If so, they're to be cross-fired and knocked down dead. At once and with no warning, you understand?
Yeah. And the tail after?
Why, that the oil and the tankers must have been their business, Jonas said with a crooked smile, to be taken to Farson at their command and by Confederates unknown. We'll be carried through the streets on the town's shoulders, come reap, hailed as the men who rooted out the traitors. Where's Roy?
Gone back to Hanging Rock? I saw him at noon. He says they're coming, Eldred. Says when the wind swings into the east he can hear approaching horse.
Maybe he only hears what he wants to hear.
But he suspected DePape was right. Jonas's mood, at rock bottom when he stepped into the Traveler's Rest, was now very much on the rebound.
We'll start moving the tankers soon, whether the brats come or not. At night and two by two, like the animals going on board old Pa's Ark.
He laughed at this.
But we'll leave some, eh? Like cheese in a trap.
Suppose the mice don't come? Jonas shrugged.
If not one way, another. I intend to press them a little more tomorrow. I want them angry, and I want them confused. Now go on about your business. I have yon lady waiting.
Better you than me, Eldred. Jonas nodded. He guessed that half an hour from now he would have forgotten all about his aching leg.
That's right, he said. You should eat like fudge.
He walked back to the bar, where Coral stood with her arms folded. Now she unfolded them and took his hands. The right she put on her left breast. The nipple was hard and erect under his fingers. The forefinger of his left hand she put in her mouth and bit down lightly.
"Shall we bring the bottle?" Jonas asked.
"Why not?" said Coral Thorin. 8. If she'd gone to sleep as drunk as had been her habit over the last few months, the creak of the bedsprings wouldn't have awakened her. A bomb blast wouldn't have awakened her. But although they'd brought the bottle, it still stood on the night table of the bedroom she maintained at the Rest. It was as big as any three of the Horror's cribs put together, the level of the whiskey unchanged. She felt sore all over her body, but her head was clear. Sex was good for that much anyway. Jonas was at the window, looking out at the first gray traces of daylight and pulling his pants up. His bare back was covered with crisscrossed scars. She thought to ask him who had administered such a savage flogging and how he'd survived it, then decided she'd do better to keep quiet.
"Where are you off to?" she asked.
"I believe I'm going to start by finding some paint, any shade will do, and a street mutt still in possession of its tail. After that, Si, I don't think you want to know."
"Very well."
She lay down and pulled the covers up to her chin. She felt she could sleep for a week. Jonas yanked on his boots and went to the door, buckling his gun belt. He paused with his hand on the knob. She looked at him, grayish eyes already half filled with sleep again.
"I've never had better," Jonas said.
Coral smiled.
"No, Callie," she said. "Nor I."